Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, Brian Lynn reports on the explosive launch of a SpaceX rocket. I have a story on a free speech dispute in a small American town. John Russell has this week's everyday grammar lesson about common sentence structures that are used while driving. Later, we listen to the next part in our American history series. But first,
a SpaceX rocket successfully launched with the company's Starship spacecraft Thursday, but the two-part system exploded minutes later and crashed into the sea. It was the first test flight for SpaceX's latest Super Heavy rocket, which carries a large space capsule on top, called Starship. The capsule is designed to one day carry astronauts and supplies to the moon and possibly Mars. No astronauts were on board for the test flight. The liftoff happened Thursday morning at a SpaceX launch center in the southern Texas town of Boca Chica. SpaceX officials have described the two-part rocket ship, which stands 120 meters high, as the largest and most powerful space vehicle ever built. The vehicle is by far more powerful than any rockets built by the American space agency, NASA. The flight plan had called for the Super Heavy to separate from Starship minutes after the launch. But instead, the rocket began to tumble and then exploded 4 minutes into the flight. The combined vehicle then fell into the Atlantic Ocean's Gulf of Mexico. The spacecraft reached an altitude of nearly 32 kilometers before exploding. The Super Heavy rocket is designed to be reusable, but for the test flight, no landings of the rocket or spacecraft were planned. Images appeared to show that several of the 33 main engines were not firing as the rocket climbed from the launch site. There was no immediate comment from SpaceX on any engine failures. SpaceX had hoped that after separating, the spacecraft would continue flying and attempt to circle the world before crashing into the Pacific Ocean near Hawaii. Even though the vehicle exploded soon after launching, SpaceX officials on the ground celebrated the fact that the rocket was able to get off the ground. The company declared the event a successful test flight. John Innsbrucker is one of the leaders of SpaceX's engineering team. He said during a live webcast of the launch that the test flight would provide a wealth of important data as the company prepares for additional flight tests. Elon Musk, the founder and chief executive of SpaceX, said on Twitter, "The next Starship test launch would be in a few months." He tweeted, "Congrats at SpaceX team on an exciting test launch of Starship. Learned a lot for next test launch." In the weeks leading up to the flight, Musk predicted a 50-50 chance that the spacecraft would reach orbit. But he had also said he was guaranteeing excitement for the launch. I'm Brian Lynn.
the line between art and advertising. The question is central to a big dispute in a small American town. A large painting in Conway, New Hampshire, has led to a zoning conflict, a First Amendment legal action, and a local vote. It started with a high school art project to paint a picture on a building in the town. The building houses a store called Leavitt's Country Bakery. The picture shows the sun shining over mountains of chocolate and strawberry donuts, a cinnamon roll, and a blueberry muffin. These are the kinds of sweet treats found in bakeries. Then the town zoning board got involved. It decided that the painting was more advertising than art. Officials said that as an advertisement, the sign was too big. Its size violated town rules. The board ordered the sign be removed or changed. Bakery owner Sean Young faced possible fines if he did not follow the order. So he decided to fight it in court. Young's legal action accuses the town of Conway of violating his right to free speech, guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution. They said it would be art elsewhere, Young told the Associated Press. It's just not art here. The dispute has the town of 10,000 people debating big questions about creativity and freedom. Conway is in the White Mountains, a popular area with visitors. The town is under pressure to increase business development. Some residents worry that compromises with development interests will lead to unwanted changes to their town. Many, including the zoning board members, liked the students' work, but they said rules must be followed. At about 8.6 square meters, the mural is 4 times bigger than zoning rules permit for advertising signs. At town meetings, residents discussed how to define a sign. Then, last week, they voted against changes to the rules. The local newspaper said the wording of the proposed changes was not clear. A judge may have to make the final decision on what remains an open debate in town. The lawsuit Young filed in January asks that the court prevent the town from enforcing its sign law. The lawsuit argues that the town's definition of sign is very general, and its zoning rules do not include the word mural. Board member Luigi Bartolomeo said he thinks the painting at the bakery is art, not advertising. "I think it's a very badly written piece of code here," said Bartolomeo, who recently retired. But board chairperson John Colbath said the board has to work with the rule, which was approved by voters. He argues that the mural would likely be seen as art and not advertising if its subject did not represent the products found at Leavitt's.
Imagine you are in a car. Perhaps another person is driving. What kinds of sentences are you likely to hear or use? In today's Everyday Grammar, we will show you how cars can teach you about English grammar. You will learn about common sentence structures that are used while driving. We will also make some car comparisons to help you remember grammar points. Let's start with a few important ideas about sentences. A car is a vehicle for getting people or goods across an area. We can think of a sentence as a vehicle for getting information across to other people. Just as there are different kinds of cars, vans, trucks, sports cars, and so on, there are also different kinds of sentences. Some sentences might be used for special purposes, just as a car might be used for a special purpose. We will now consider two sentence types that are commonly used while driving in cars: imperative sentences and exclamatory sentences. A quick reminder about sentences. Complete sentences involve a subject and a predicate. But some kinds of sentences only suggest the subject. One example is the imperative sentence, commonly used to give driving instructions or directions. The imperative sentence generally only consists of a predicate. The predicate often has the base form of the verb as well as additional information. Let's imagine that you are riding in a car. You are in the passenger seat and someone else is driving.
Which way should I turn?
Turn left at the stop sign. Here we have the imperative, turn left at the stop sign. The sentence involves the base form of the verb turn along with the direction left. We also have the phrase at the stop sign. We use imperatives to give all kinds of instructions when riding in a car. For example, you might say, start the car, park the car, speed up, slow down, put on the parking brake, and so on. Now, let's turn our attention to a second kind of sentence you are likely to hear or use when driving: exclamatory sentences. Grammar books describe exclamatory sentences in terms of emotion and in terms of word order. Let's explore both of these in turn. The first way we describe exclamatory sentences is in terms of emotion. In other words, exclamatory sentences can be any kind of sentence that is spoken with more emotion. And when we are driving, that emotion is often, but not always, negative. For example,
I can't believe he cut me off.
The second kind of exclamatory sentence involves a change of word order. We often use what or how in these kinds of statements. We also often leave out the verb. Imagine you are on a peaceful drive on a beautiful fall day. The trees are red, orange, and yellow. You might say,
what a lovely day.
Now imagine you are stuck in heavy traffic. A person speeds up and cuts in front of you. You might say in a negative tone,
what a piece of work.
Or something like this,
what the?
This kind of exclamatory sentence is not polite, and we do not suggest using it. But you might hear it, or something like it, in a film or in real life. We have explored two kinds of sentences: imperative sentences and exclamatory sentences. You might compare imperative sentences to race cars. Race cars are about speed and quickness, so they might not have some parts that weigh them down. Similarly, imperatives are about speed and quickness in communication. Imperatives are reduced to simple elements, the predicate with the base form of the verb. We also explored two kinds of exclamatory statements. Exclamatory sentences suggest colorful emotions. We might compare exclamatory statements to colorful cars: bright yellow, deep orange, brilliant red. Of course, none of these comparisons are perfect, but they can give you a general way to remember ideas about different kinds of sentences. I'm John Russell.
You just heard John Russell present this week's Everyday Grammar. John joins us now to talk a little bit more about the lesson. Welcome, John.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me on the show.
So, why did you choose to connect cars with imperative sentences and exclamatory sentences?
We break down English sentences into several types: declarative, interrogative, imperative, exclamatory, or fragment. Of course, you will hear all of these kinds of sentences to different degrees in different situations. But for me, cars, and driving experiences more generally, connect with two sentence types in particular: imperative and exclamatory sentences.
I do have strong memories of using both sentence types while driving.
Me too. That's the point of the story, to connect personal experiences to some topic in grammar. Grammar can be very abstract, but when we connect grammar to something we are familiar with, it becomes much more meaningful and memorable.
Great. Thank you for coming on the show today, John.
Thank you. See you next time.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue to discuss the events of the 1930s and American foreign policy during that time. For much of its history, the United States was not involved in world disputes. Only in the 20th century did it become a powerful and influential nation. President Theodore Roosevelt was the first president to see America as a great power. A few years later, President Woodrow Wilson wanted the United States to become more involved in the world. Many Americans disagreed. They wanted to stay out of international conflicts. The presidents after Wilson stayed informed about world events, but they were much less willing to involve the United States than Roosevelt or Wilson had been. The Great Economic Depression that began in 1929 reduced Americans' interest in the world even more. Now, here are Doug Johnson and Shirley Griffith.
Franklin Roosevelt became president in 1933. Franklin Roosevelt was not like most Americans. He knew the international situation well from his own experience. Like Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, he wanted to expand America's foreign policies. The terrible crisis of the Depression, however, forced him to spend most of his time on national economic issues. He was able to deal with international issues only very slowly. One of his most important first efforts was to improve relations with Latin American nations.
30 years earlier, President Theodore Roosevelt said the United States had the right to intervene in Latin America. In the years that followed, the United States sent troops to several Latin American countries. Many political leaders in the area accused the United States of treating them like children. Leaders throughout Latin America criticized the United States bitterly at a conference in 1928. When Franklin Roosevelt became president, he promised to treat Latin American nations as friends. He called this his good neighbor policy.
I would dedicate this nation to the policy of the good neighbor, the neighbor who resolutely respects himself and because he does so, respects the rights of others. The neighbor who respects his obligations and respects the sanctity of his agreements in and with a world of neighbors.
Roosevelt's new policy had an unfriendly beginning. His administration refused to recognize a government in Cuba that opposed the United States. Instead, it helped bring to power a new government that showed more support for the United States. After that, however, President Roosevelt was able to prove that he wanted to improve relations with the countries of Latin America. For example, his administration speeded up plans to withdraw American troops from Haiti. It rejected old treaties that gave the United States the right to intervene in Cuba. It recognized a revolutionary government in El Salvador. It recognized the right of Panama to help operate and protect the Panama Canal. And it helped establish the Export-Import Bank to increase trade throughout the Americas.
All of these actions did much to improve the opinion of Latin American leaders about the United States. However, the most important test of Franklin Roosevelt's new policies was in Mexico. The Mexican government seized control of oil companies owned by investors in the United States. A number of influential Americans wanted the president to take strong action. He refused. He only agreed to urge the Mexican government to pay American investors for the value of the oil companies.
As United States relations with Latin America improved, its relations with Britain got worse. Britain blamed Franklin Roosevelt for the failure of an international economic conference in 1933. It also felt the United States Congress was unwilling to take a strong position against international aggression by other nations. Some British leaders had so little faith in Roosevelt that they proposed seeking cooperation with Japan instead of the United States. New leaders in Japan, however, soon ended this possibility. They presented Britain with such strong military demands that the British government gave up any idea of cooperation with Japan.
One big question in American foreign policy in the 1930s concerned the Soviet Union. The United States had refused to recognize the government in Moscow after the Bolsheviks took control in 1917. Yet Franklin Roosevelt saw the Soviet Union as a possible ally if growing tensions in Europe and Asia burst into war. For this reason, he held talks in Washington with a top Soviet official. In 1933, he officially recognized the Soviet government.
President Roosevelt hoped recognition would lead to better relations. But the United States and the Soviet Union did not trust each other. They immediately began arguing about many issues. Within 2 years, the American ambassador to Moscow urged President Roosevelt to cut diplomatic relations with the Soviets. Roosevelt refused. Relations between the two countries became even worse. Yet Roosevelt believed it was better to continue relations in case of an emergency. That emergency, World War II, was just a few years away.
Economic issues played an important part in American foreign policy during the early 1930s. In 1933, a major international economic conference was held in London. France and Italy led a movement to link the value of every nation's money to the price of gold. American delegates to the conference rejected the idea. They argued that it would slow America's recovery from the Great Depression. As a result, the London conference failed. Although President Roosevelt opposed linking the value of the American dollar to the price of gold, he did not oppose international trade. During the 1930s, his administration negotiated new trade agreements with more than 20 countries.
The 1930s saw major political changes in Asia and Europe. President Roosevelt watched these developments with great interest. In Japan, military leaders gained control of the government. Their goal was to make Japan Asia's leading power. In Italy, the government was headed by fascist Benito Mussolini. Another fascist, Francisco Franco, seized power in Spain. And most important, Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party increased their strength in Germany. Franklin Roosevelt understood much sooner than most Western leaders the threat that these new leaders represented.
Most Americans shared Roosevelt's dislike for the new fascist movements. However, Americans felt another emotion much more strongly. It was their desire to stay out of war. World War I had just ended 15 years earlier. It was still fresh in the minds of many Americans. A majority of the population opposed any policy that could involve the United States in another bloody conflict.
A public opinion study was made in 1937. The study showed that 71% of Americans believed it had been a mistake for the United States to fight in World War I. So President Roosevelt was not surprised when Congress passed a law ordering the administration to remain neutral in any foreign conflict. Congress also refused an administration proposal that the United States join the World Court. Franklin Roosevelt shared the hope that the United States would stay out of foreign conflicts. However, Adolf Hitler and other fascists continued to grow more powerful. The situation forced Americans to begin to consider the need for military strength.
Americans did not want to become involved in another world war. They called on President Roosevelt and their representatives in Congress to remain neutral in world affairs. But aggression by Germany and Japan would force Americans to choose between their desire for democracy and their desire for peace.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.